You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. I'm thrilled to welcome back Dr. Elizabeth Sandel for part two of our conversation on the brain, traumatic brain injury, and concussion. Welcome back, Dr. Sandel.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to continuing our conversation.
So, you know, in part one, we talked about the overview of concussion and brain injury and all the populations that it affects. I'd really like to focus in on two specific populations, sports injuries and the military, because I think we see so much recently, there's been so much awareness around injuries in these populations. Let's start off with sports injuries. This is happening a lot with kids and adolescents, as well as professional athletes. Why are these injuries so concerning?
Well, I think it's probably because there's so many kids playing sports. It's actually not just about the NFL or other professional sports. It's a huge percentage of kids who are playing these sports. So lots of parents and lots of kids even who are having second thoughts about playing what we call collision sports. And of course, the collision sports have been growing in number. I remember when I was in high school and college, basketball was not a collision sport. So you
I was
have,
just going to ask you to define, because when I think of collision sports, I think of hockey, ice hockey, and football, but you're saying basketball is now considered a collision sport.
Right. So the rules have changed to allow for more aggressive play. And women, by the way, as I mentioned in part one, have a higher incidence. And that's true in basketball. So playing the same sport, basketball, soccer, lacrosse, those are all collision sports. And girls and women are having higher numbers of concussions and more prolonged symptoms.
Wow.
So these are the collision sports. I suppose baseball and softball are not collision sports. There's some colliding. Some injury-related, injury-related concussions, obviously, but it's not considered a collision sport. So we have the non-contact or low contact, and then we have the collision sports. Athletics has become very competitive, and that's for women as well as men. And, you know, I remember when Title IX came in, right? And Title IX really opened up the world of athletics for women. But now we have this situation where we've got to figure out what is really going on biologically, if it is a biological phenomenon primarily, or if it's something else. So the biological possibilities are anatomic. It could be the movement that girls and women make and heading the ball, for example, in soccer. So we call that kinesiology. So that's the science of movement. Could it be hormonal? So women are more prone to migraine headaches. So is that why they have a higher incidence of post-traumatic headache? Neck muscles. So neck muscles potentially weaker in many women. Is that the cause? And then the big question is it symptom reporting? So are women more likely to talk about their symptoms, report their symptoms, and try to seek help? Are men and boys, perhaps especially athletes, less likely to do so? So we haven't really figured that out, but we do see underreporting in both male and female athletes being a real problem. And it's interesting because that's in contrast to, of course, worker injuries, where maybe we have another phenomenon going on, which is if people don't like their work and they've had an injury at work, maybe they're less motivated to go back, whereas athletes seem to really be motivated, especially professional athletes. But also kids that are trying to get into college, for example, right, with a college scholarship, they're really pushing themselves too. So that's kind of the situation in terms of what we know and what we don't know about sex differences and so forth.
And that's so interesting, the differences in, you know, in gender and play. We hear all these stories and we've seen them in the news, even with professional athletes, but certainly with high school students and general school students in sports where, you know, there's an incident, there's a collision, and they're told by the coach to just shake it off and return to play. And why is that so dangerous to do that?
Well, I mentioned, I think, in part one about second impact syndrome, and I think that that's what has really produced much more awareness that something really dire could happen, including death, if that player goes back. So I do think there's been more awareness and more sticking to protocol, a lot more protocols out there. But again, it's difficult because how do you make the diagnosis, right? And how do you make the diagnosis if the player isn't reporting symptoms? And yeah, they staggered a little bit after the hit, but they're shaking it off. But I do think there's evidence that if they're athletic trainers at games, and of course that varies, who's paying for the athletic trainers, right? It's going to be right. More the colleges, not the high schools or middle schools, right? So, but if they're athletic trainers, if there's somebody alert and watching and making sure and has some training in concussion management and so forth, that's a much better situation. So we have all this variation across the country in terms of what's available on the playing field at both practices and games. And of course, practices happen more often than games. So concussions are happening a lot in practices.
Right. So for the younger kids and adolescents, what are the long-term effects of concussions in that age group?
So the typical sequelae, shall we call it, consequences, are a combination of symptoms that tend to be things like headaches would be the most common, dizziness, insomnia, but a whole long list of other symptoms. And those symptoms each need to be targeted in terms of treatment. And they don't vary that much across the age groups, but they vary from person to person. So some people might have more cognitive difficulties, and some people might have more mood-related symptoms, and some people might have more headaches, and that's their most predominant symptom. So again, treatment has to be individualized, and again, based on the age of the child or adolescent or adult, it has to be individualized. And again, we're kind of at a loss for that silver bullet to go for the cure. We have to think about this in terms of a symptom management strategy. And then again, education and teaching self-management, you know, especially older kids. And I think the other thing is guiding the young person, through the course of the disorder, and getting them back first to what we call return to learn, and then eventually return to play. So they first get back to school before they get back to play. So these are the guidelines, and there are guidelines for the reentry into both school and to play.
I can see how this can be just so confusing, because if you think about, you know, mood as being a symptom, right? And then you have an adolescent, and adolescents are moody on a good day.
That's
with
right.
all their hormonal changes. And so how do you, you know, it's got to be really difficult to know what's attributed to growth and development in kids and adolescents, and what's the result of an injury?
Excellent comment, because that's why this is a quote mild injury in terms of some crude measures, but it's a complex disorder, right? So that's why it takes more time to evaluate. It takes more time to provide care for this population because of the complexity. And I will say that in my practice over the decades, I have to work with neuropsychologists. Primary specialty, I think, in terms of running a concussion clinic, providing care to people, you've got to have this team of people. The neuropsychologist is key, because that person is trained to evaluate both the cognitive disorders and also the psychological disorders, and help to plan and strategize treatment. There are other key people on the team, in particular physical therapists, who treat some of the pain, the painful conditions, headaches even, if they're related to neck injuries and so forth, and vestibular therapists, if there's dizziness or balance problems. And there are certainly speech therapists who are trained to deliver cognitive therapy and help with school reentry, for example. So again, it takes a team.
Team, yeah.
It's a pretty labor intensive for those kids who have what we call post-concussion syndrome,
right,
or disorder.
I have more questions for you about treatment, but before we do that, let's talk about another population, which is the military. I recently read a statistic that Navy SEALs sustain on average 80 concussions just during their basic training. That's before they're deployed and they're going to combat. And I saw some new research that has shown that combat and exposure to explosions can leave microscopic tears in a person's brain that causes all kinds of symptoms like headache and trouble sleeping and memory issues, but it doesn't show up, as you were talking about, on a CAT scan. It doesn't show up. And so they have all these tests, and then they're told this is in your head, and they're suffering from massive amounts of PTSD, but also brain injury, and just the impact of that. So let's talk a little bit about the military.
Well, that's an excellent topic. And I think in the military, both blunt and blast injuries are a cause of traumatic brain injury. Now, the blast injuries can cause damage to other organs in addition to the brain. So these are really severe, can be severe and obvious injuries in some cases. So what happens is the blast wave from these explosions actually operates a little differently than what we discussed before with the shaking of the brain, the inertial injuries. Although in some cases the person is thrown. And so it is, it's similar to what I was speaking about before with a jolt or a blow. But these blast injuries involve the blast wave and energy entering through the body through different entry points. So that could be the ears, the nose, the mouth, and it could be the vascular system, even the eyes. So there's a different mechanism of injury with the blast injuries. But what you're speaking about is similar to what we see with concussion and other situations, where there's a microscopic injury that is invisible and not seen on routine scans. So that's essentially what's happening. And I talked about the G-forces. There are other measures for this with these blast injuries, but they're just subtle enough or just low enough force that they're not manifest in terms of symptoms. But over time, one worries about progressive damage to the brain. And of course, the time between these blast injuries probably plays a role too. It's similar to athletes going back too soon to play. So repetitive injuries, as you're speaking of, really presents the possibility that there's a cumulative effect from these explosions. I think we'll be finding more and more out about it. From my reading, the pathology that's seen by pathologists under the microscope is actually pretty similar to what we see with the more blunt injuries. But I think time will tell what the relationship is here with what we see with repetitive injury from other causes, including especially sports.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about more severe brain injury. Years ago, I worked at a traumatic brain injury facility and was working with individuals, you know, stuntmen who'd got into serious accidents. One kid was dead by his friends to run across the freeway and was hit by a car. You know, much more serious accidents. Another interesting one was a woman who had a frozen turkey on her back seat and she slammed on her brakes and the turkey took flight and hit her in the back of the head. You know, things you don't think about. From that day, I've never put a frozen anything on the seat behind me. Like, that has stuck with me. But, you know, that's obviously more severe blunt trauma that you're talking about. Can people recover from that? I mean, is the treatment very different? I'm assuming that would have a more severe long-term impact and short-term impact.
Right. I've certainly cared for many people who've had something like that happen. Now, this isn't just a little bump in the head. This requires a force, significant force. And again, we don't have a way to measure that. But we certainly see people who have these chronic conditions after just one event. And I think, again, we're back to the question of how do we measure severity? And we measure it by symptoms. And as long as that's the case, we're not going to be able to really do much in terms of prediction. But again, everybody needs to be treated individually and with a symptom-based strategy and so forth. And these blunt injuries, in most cases, I think people will have a good recovery if they have had what we call a mild brain injury. But there is a subset of people who don't fully recover.
Right. So there are two bad outcomes that you and I have talked about. One is post-concussion syndrome, and the other is neurodegenerative disease. So let's first talk about post-concussion syndrome. Can you describe that to us?
Sure. So the post-concussion syndrome, a lot of people say, is not a syndrome. So we'll start there. And of course, a syndrome means that it's pretty consistent in terms of the symptoms that people have. And so many years ago, there was a lot of talk about calling it a post-concussion disorder, using that term. It's still called a post-concussion syndrome by the World Health Organization. And they've attempted to take all those symptoms that can occur that have been reported to occur after concussion and kind of boil them down. And so they have a list of 8 symptoms. If you have 3 of them, you've got the diagnosis. I don't like to dwell too much on that, but I do think, again, we do need to know, did this person have headaches before? Right? Were they treated for depression before? Did they have trauma before? Could they have post-traumatic stress disorder? Because this is a second traumatic event and they have a reemergence of symptoms from a previous PTSD or acute stress disorder that happened to them because of something else. So again, we have to kind of figure out why the symptoms are there. Are they new and so forth? But it's this collection of symptoms that we see on the symptom checklist. So people go in to see their doctor. They may use one of these symptom checklists and go through the symptoms. And typically, it's about 3 out of 8 of the typical symptoms. So they would be headaches, dizziness, insomnia, maybe some cognitive difficulties and so forth. Now, when we evaluate people we therefore are going to probably do a screening test for cognitive problems, and we will do a screening test for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I think women especially should be asked about intimate partner violence, because we're seeing a huge incidence of head trauma, brain injury, reported by women who do report that they've been victims of intimate partner violence. So there's some very important things that we do in terms of screening and that those first evaluations. And then people will have dizziness or even vertigo, or things spin. They're spinning, the room's spinning. Those problems are most likely due to some disruption of the systems of the vision and vestibular function in the brain. And now there's some pretty sophisticated tests for looking at that in the clinic. And of course, then we have therapists that will focus on that as well and help people with the home programs and so forth for vestibular function and vision.
Can post-concussion syndrome resolve without treatment, or do you have to get treatment?
Good question. I think that you will see it resolve in some people. We don't have good studies on that. We don't have good longitudinal studies, actually. And of course, there are ethical issues too. Do we design a study where these people get treatment and these people don't?
Right, so, of course.
You know, we have those issues, but it's an excellent question. And I think there's a natural history to it, but we can speed up recovery, I do believe. And we can have a better chance at a good outcome if we follow people, you know, from the beginning and follow them until their symptoms resolve. Right. So that's post-concussion syndrome.
Right. What about neurodegenerative disease? I'm assuming we're talking about things like Alzheimer's, dementia.
Right. So those disorders would include, as you say, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. I would also include amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. By the way, Lou Gehrig probably had a genetic form. He probably didn't have that disorder because he was in sports.
What about Lewy body syndrome? Is that in this classification or is that separate?
That has not, to my knowledge, been directly connected. But I will say, if you look at Parkinson's disease research, you will see that head trauma, as it's sometimes called, or brain injury is one of the risk factors. And probably the strongest evidence for an association between brain injury and Parkinson's, and neurodegenerative diseases is Parkinson's. Now, Alzheimer's disease has also been connected, and it's been connected through some genetic factors. First of all, apolipoprotein allele, so a particular genetic factor, has been linked and associated with both Alzheimer's and traumatic brain injury and its connection with Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is more common in women. Parkinson's disease more common in men. ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, more common in men. Now, chronic traumatic encephalopathy is interesting. We don't know if it's more common in men. It's been mostly studied in men. Okay, and this is the disorder that was named by Bennett Omalu when he did a postmortem examination of the brain of Mike Webster, who played for the Pittsburgh Steelers. So hence the movie, the book, the movie, Concussion. So that term, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, is actually linked with boxers. So that term was first used. Another term was dementia pugilistica. So it's been known for at least a century that there's this connection between repetitive concussions and neurodegenerative diseases. But we don't have all this worked out, of course. We know that there's some disruption of proteins, tau protein, amyloid protein, and there may even be a situation where these proteins are going haywire. And those are called prions, and they are associated with, for example, mad cow disease.
Wow. Okay.
And so, again, this is, we're not sure that this actually happens in humans, but it has been studied in cells in the laboratory. And these proteins just get a little deranged and start moving and causing destruction. So a lot of this hasn't been worked out, but it does seem to be a situation where proteins that have normal roles in the brain, tau, amyloid, somehow are activated, or their activity is blocked, for example, and they begin to accumulate and cause further destruction. But what's really interesting to me is not everybody gets CTE, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS from playing repetitive sports. Collision sports.
Collision sports, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that we don't have the answers to that question, but we do know that it increases risk. And so then the question is, for all those people, and you mentioned the Navy SEALs for the military group, but also for athletes, and we see some athletes leaving the sport, right, because of this, because of the risk. It's certainly not 100%, but it does appear to increase risk enough that people are having second thoughts.
So let's move on to treatment. What is good post-injury care? What does that look like? I know you mentioned earlier that it's a team of different people with different areas of specialty, but what does good post-injury care look like?
Sure. So again, I think, you know, we have to start with the history, and we have to gather a lot of information. And so for me, that is usually at least an hour talking to a person about what's happened, what they remember, and of course, more time looking at medical records and so forth. And then doing some very specific screening, as I mentioned, too, for cognitive and mood disorders. And then, ideally, the physician, whoever the physician is, has a treatment team available. And so that would be a neuropsychologist, physical therapist, speech therapist, sometimes an occupational therapist, and a vestibular therapist, very important to help with the management. So you've got this team of people, and then what does the physician do? Well, the physician's prescribing medication and coordinating services. And those services might require other physicians to be involved too. So there might be other kinds of referrals and so forth. I think there's a question about rest and exercise that I have to talk about, because for decades, the traditional thinking was people should go to, you know, should rest, right? They shouldn't be active. And even perhaps go into a dark room.
Right, right.
And that is not been shown to be effective. So now it's a gradual return, shall we say, to kind of pre-injury life. And certainly, I think a graded exercise program is really important. So starting slow, maybe that's just walking the dog, but increasing the activity level and aerobic exercise, I think, is really important. That's been shown to be really effective for brain recovery and regularizing sleep, very important. But I must say, in that regard, one of the things that I'm reassured by is the research on sleep that shows that the brain during sleep is actually removing toxins. There's a system that has been discovered just recently called the glymphatic system, right? You probably read about that.
Right, yeah.
And that is so important. So over the years, I've told people, you don't want to sleep your life away, but you want to allow yourself perhaps to get more sleep after your concussion. So that turns out to be good advice, still good advice. But regularizing the sleep pattern is also good, and then incorporating exercise program. And then I think medications for headache often are necessary, although many of the headaches are what we call cervicogenic. So they are coming from the neck. They're not necessarily migraines and won't respond to migraine medication. But again, we have to determine exactly what type of headache and be pretty targeted in treating that. And there's some other medications that could be helpful, of course, for painful conditions, for dizziness even. So it's a combination of medication and therapies.
And if you're the parent of a young child in elementary school or high school who's, you know, had a collision on during practice, what kind of doctor do you go to? There isn't a concussion clinic in every city. So typically parents might go to their pediatrician, and the pediatrician may not be as well informed on the importance of this and the proper treatment. So who should parents go to?
That's a really good question. And one I struggle with, because I do get people contacting me through my website asking for help about this. And there's certainly plenty of concussion clinics that are cropping up around the country, but like everything else in our country, there's variation in care, and there's not a concussion clinic everywhere. And some of the concussion clinics are geared more toward athletes and may actually even limit who can come into the clinic. So there's that issue. But I think in general, and I have a certain bias here, I'll admit to that, I think the rehabilitation centers, because they're usually staffed with neuropsychologists and therapists and PM&R doctors, physiatrists, some of whom have a subspecialty, as I do, in brain injury medicine. That's always worked for me. Again, having all those people around to help and having everybody kind of on the same page in terms of understanding the problem and the problems that have occurred because of the concussion. So that's ideal. But I can tell you, when I get patients contacting me or their families contacting me, and they say, I'm from a certain town in Oregon or Mississippi, or I do my best using my national network, but often it's tough to direct people to the right place.
There's not going to be a specialist in every city.
That's right.
So my last question for you is, if you have sustained a concussion and you have not treated it for 5 years or 8 years, and you then seek out treatment, can you recover? Can you make progress, maybe not recover fully, but can you still recover in some way, even if there's been a long delay between injury and the beginning of treatment?
Well, that's a good question. And that study hasn't been done. The study to answer that question hasn't been done, but I will comment in two ways. One is, there is some evidence from at least one study that by the end of 3 years, people don't recover more function. However, I have treated patients. My second answer is, I have treated patients who have had a problem 5 years ago who need a specific targeted treatment for a specific symptom and improve. So in my field, we don't necessarily write people off in that way. And so, again, I would say they should seek out help. And perhaps it's not due to the concussion. Because one of the other things we see with people is they may misattribute this is no fault on their part, but they may say, oh, the headaches happened after my concussion. And the headaches are maybe due to something else.
Right, right.
We deserve treatment for that, whatever. So we see that phenomenon as well. And I would encourage anyone in that situation to try to get answers and get help.
Well, thank you so much. You've given us so much information and insight. I feel like I've had a biology lesson and a medical class. and it's really been fantastic. I've learned so much, and I know our listeners are going to learn so much from you as well. So thank you so much for your time and for sharing all this great information with us.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure. And I wish you the best of luck in your work as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.